G'day. Thanks for joining us in this Broadway Spotlight edition of the Stages podcast, a Spotlight replay brought to you by Academy Travel, a leading specialist in small group cultural tours. And we've got exciting news for you. Join me in January 2024 as Academy Travel takes us to the city that never sleeps on an immersive and jam-packed adventure into theatre, opera, jazz and cabaret. A 10-day tour in which we will sample the best of Broadway, the Metropolitan Opera and jazz in Brooklyn, alongside a host of cultural experiences at museums and galleries populating the Big Apple. As your stage's host, I'll be leading the tour, accompanying participants in an exciting array of activities that are bound to delight, thrill, and engage the eager theatre fan. What can be better than diving into arts and culture in the greatest city in the world, the Big Apple, the city that never sleeps? Find further information at the Academy Travel website, academytravel.com.au, and search Theatre in New York Best of Broadway Tour. To whet the appetite, Stages will be visiting conversations with Australian artists who conquered the Great White Way in a series of Broadway Spotlight episodes, brought to you by Academy Travel. Kay Tuckerman played Broadway in the Donna Summer musical and has appeared in extensive musical theatre product around the globe. She relishes living in the Big Apple and all that it offers culturally to its inhabitants and many visitors. Kay Tuckerman joined the Stages podcast in April 2023.
Oh God, I hope I get the questions right.
No, it's good. It's not a quiz, Kay.
Just say it was and I got them wrong.
And if it was a quiz, you're the specialist subject.
I know. This might be worse if I got it wrong. Or I might look at some revisionist history and for the hard bits.
Well, Kay Tuckerman, it's lovely to see you.
Ah, thanks. This is so nice to be here.
You're back in Australia. Of course, residing in New York at the moment.
Yeah.
Is that home now?
That's a good question. I've been there, 12 years now? 2 years on the road and then 10 years in New York. So I don't know. And I was actually talking to the excellent Tony McGill, who's now over at Brent Street, the other day about the psychology of the global nomad and how you travel so much. And I think the Aussies generally do travel so much, you know, either with tours, with shows around Australia, Asia, New Zealand, or then they go to the West End and then they do all the tours around England and Europe, or they go to America and they do all the tours around America and stuff. And there's this aspect of the global nomad psychology whereby you are excited to be wherever you're going to be, but at the same time you belong wherever you put your hat, yet belong nowhere.
Yeah.
So it's quite a complex mindset, I think. So I'm not sure. I'm not even sure about where home is anymore. I'm not sure even if, you know, wherever you put your hat, I don't even know if that would be my home. I don't know. I just keep on rolling with the flow of the river and rolling with the punches.
Yeah, so, it's a wonderful adventure.
Yeah.
And until you're able to, I guess, buy a property or buy furniture, or that's when you can start to perhaps construct or design a home. But you're just happy.
Oh, I'm just doing my thing.
Yeah.
Got a cat.
Have
cat will travel. Or actually have dog will travel. Have cat, it's a bit harder. Especially if they're as dumb as my cat. Like, mind you, he wouldn't know where he was, so that's all right.
Wonderful. Well, welcome back to Australia.
Thank
for this
you.
Brief time.
And it's always lovely to be here, you know. And I know when I was back pre-pandemic and, you know, had the opportunity to do Claire's Kitchen and Adelaide Cabaret Festival and go up to Queensland and do Wicked with Matt Ward up at Hoda. It's just glorious whenever I have a chance to be home and to either see shows or perform here. Like, there's something about performing in Australia, either as a performer yourself or watching the Aussies. There's something so thrilling about the level of discipline and skill and joie de vivre and passion and joy that you see. Like, you can tell an Australian performer on stage. Yeah. There's something just beautiful about that energy.
Is it tough being away from family? I mean, I find it tough. And my mum is only in another state. Yours is in another country.
I know. It's a really good question because, and I know during the pandemic, when you couldn't get home And I know like I have a couple of friends in New York that lost their parents during that time, could not get home, even going to, you know, the embassy in Australia and begging for some sort of, you know, leniency or compassionate, like, visa to get into the country, they couldn't. And to know that, you know, was their choice to live in another country, now impacted by a pandemic, impacted by global travel rules, meant that, you know, at the end of days of their, you know, their mom or dad's life, they didn't get to, you know, experience that, no matter how painful it was. But, and so, it is hard. It is hard when, you know, you come back and, you know, you see nieces and nephews. Like, I saw mine last night and they're like, oh, you're 30? You're 22? It was like, and then, of course, the next part of that is, how old am I? Oh, my God. Like, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know. At least technology now allows us to, you know, it's no longer the STD phone call. And we can have Zoom and use that frequently. Yeah?
Exactly. I mean, remember the STD phone calls or the first mobile phone calls that were like $300 a minute and you'd just go, gotta go, because you knew that bill was, you know, was
or with the long distance phone call, you know, mum said, oh, there's the pips, you better go now.
You've got to go.
Clock over to another 10 minutes.
I know. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, like, video calling has, you know, made such a world of difference. And, you know, I know whenever I'll talk to my mum, she'll just be like, oh, first of all, she was worried about an iPad. But then she's like, oh, my God, this is the best thing ever. Like, to be able to see someone's face. And I'll never forget the first time we actually connected via Zoom, like via, what's it called, FaceTime. She was like, oh, I can see your face. And it's just like, it's so simple and wholesome and sweet. You just go, oh my God, this is, you know, it's something that, you know, younger people are used to, but for an older person to be able to connect like that, it's really lovely and really important.
Well, you know, the changes that occur in a lifetime. I mean, yeah, we certainly know that time before mobiles and at uni where you'd go down to the phone box once a week and that'd be the phone call home.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, I got my first cell phone in 95 and I was doing Jesus Christ Superstar and our out-of-town tryout, so to speak, was up in Newcastle and I was staying just out of Newcastle, so I was driving along the freeway every night after the show and I was like, I should get one of those mobile phones so that if anything should happen on the freeway, I could at least call an emergency vehicle or something. But that's why I got it, not like now when it's just like, I mean, it's like it's attached to you.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it is, it's an extension,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And people, just if they lose it or it breaks or something, just
can't have
a breakdown. That's just, yeah.
They do.
You cannot function because your life is in there,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and they're saying, I think the psychology of the cell phone is even if you have, so say you're working or rehearsing, then you have like your 10-minute, you know, required break as per your contract. So, of course, now people go outside, the first thing they do, pick up their cell phone on their phone. The psychology is that they've been on their phone for like 10, 15 minutes, they come back into a rehearsal room, even though they're now disconnected from it, psychologically it takes 10 to 15 minutes to undo that connection to the cell phone. So then people are not present in the room for another 10, 15 minutes.
Wow.
So bizarre.
Yeah.
Bizarre, that addiction to a device.
Yeah. We were sharing when you arrived that beautiful experience, you know, we're talking about changing technology also, of CDs and DVDs and LPs, dare I say.
Dare I say.
Where, you know, that wonderful period of time where we were talking musical theatre and the latest Sondheim show would come out and it was an event. You'd go down to your Brash's or your, you know, whatever your music store, Alan's Music. This is Sanity. This was long before JB Hi-Fi. or what was the big record store in America?
There was Tower,
Tower
was Colony,
yeah, yeah,
there was,
And yes, every trip you'd
Colony
go and
Records.
you'd buy a few LPs. And it was an event, you'd take it home and you'd listen to every lyric as it played on the turntable.
Yeah, and do you remember too, you would often have like an insert into their LP cover or the insert for the CD would have all the lyrics printed and you could either just read along or sing along with that. And we were talking about the commitment it takes to actually set aside that length of time to actually listen and go back if you've missed something, or listen for specific accidentals and harmonies, and how much, you know, you connect with something in that way. Whereas now it's like the reductiveness of society, the reductiveness via social media of like dislike. Now we've got maybe what, heart, laugh, care, wow, sad. You know, that's what it's been reduced to, as opposed to, did you spend 3 hours listening to the brand new Sondheim musical or brand new, you know, whatever offering it was? And yeah, there's something about that, and the way you connect as a human being, the way you connect to the storytelling, the way you connect as the artist to that, as opposed to, I don't like it. And it's like, well, what's that? Yeah. What conversation is there if it's just like dislike?
I was pondering the last time that we actually caught up IRL, in real life, that is. Social media can be quite, can throw a cloud over, you know, reality. And when did I actually see Kay before? Because, you know, we can interact on the facce libre from time to time in Instagram. But I would nominate that it was in the audition room of that original production of The Lion King.
I would say that is 100% correct. So we're going to go back to 2002?
Yeah, 20 years ago.
20 years ago.
20 years ago. Yeah. I was 6'2", a little tall for a warthog.
You were too tall for a warthog, I'm sorry, and way too tall for a meerkat.
Anything in the jungle, really?
Yeah, no, but you were tremendous, I recall. And I think it's an interesting process casting, you know, because I'd been at NIDA the year before that, and I'd been on the Olympics the year before that. And when I graduated from NIDA, I went on to Matrix and The Lion King. And it was such an amazing experience, an amazing privilege to be in the room with performers that way, and to appreciate the level of care it takes in the casting room, from that panel, from that table, the level of care for everyone who walks into that room, has prepared material. They may or may not nail it or absolutely screw it up in that moment. And all I can ever think, it's like, I have a friend who's an Olympic runner, and he recalls, he was on the 4x4 relay team, and he recalls being on that, and the margins were so tight, and he slipped on the block as he took off. And in that, he kept running as fast as he could, but in that moment he knew he'd blown it. He'd blown it for himself, he'd blown it for the team. And it's the first time I ever thought, it is like elite level sport. Like preparing, getting a whole like audition package, preparing that material. And sure, like, you know, we were saying that, you know, you can jump online now, you can look at productions, you can study material, you can find the exact scene for the audition package they've given you, you can practice as much as you can, you can go in that room, and for some reason, you know, you get a catch in your throat and you sing terribly, you just don't know. And I'm just like, my God, the respect I have for performers preparing, putting themselves on the line by walking into that room, doing their very best. If they mess it up, holding themselves together until they walk out of the room and get in their car and just go, or call their agents and go, I've blown it, or whatever. Mm. And I remember watching people in that room and just thinking how brilliant every single person was. And I think to anybody listening who's auditioning and worried that people on an audition panel are going, oh, that person was terrible, I never, ever, when I was at Sydney Theatre Company casting and when I was at casting for Disney Theatricals Australia, never once was there any talk of somebody. There was one, he'd gone to a nightclub the night before, so may have been still peaking while he auditioned. It was very entertaining, but in the wrong way. So don't do that. But anybody who's ever worried that an audition panel is like out there to, you know, to cut someone down or something, my experience was like just high level of respect. And it's just always a shame that you see people who are so talented, so prepared, so wonderful and deserving of a spot, and ultimately everything just gets chipped back to the one person and the cover and or the standby who's going to get that track, you know. And it's like, yeah, so I'm sorry you're too tall for a warthog.
Well, you're able to bring great empathy into the audition room, because you had been a performer yourself. Mm-hmm. And as you say, you want everybody that comes in to be the person for the job. But we've all been in those audition rooms where we haven't particularly felt welcome, or, you know, nobody ever looks up and they're just writing and you think, are they focused on me? Are they doing their lunch order? What? I mean,
yeah.
You're quite vulnerable when you walk into an audition room anyway, and your mind is perhaps working overtime and assuming things that aren't really happening.
Yeah.
You know, that resting bitch face is really just concentration from the audition panel.
100%.
Yeah.
I know that we would look at performers like literally eagle-eyed and, you know, you just go, my God, if there was a mirror on us or a camera on us right now, like that level of concentration to see, are they too tall? Are they, you know, can they do it? Could they sing that top note that we need to hear? Could they play opposite this person that, you know, we're looking to, like all of these combinations of a jigsaw puzzle. And yeah, it can lead you to be looking quite intense. But yeah, it's an interesting thing. And of course now, you know, not everything, we're starting to go back into the room, but the whole self-tape thing, and you do feel like you're acting or singing into a vacuum. You listen back to a singing self-tape, and there's only so much a phone can do in terms of recording, you know, a big belty song. So this is a whole different ball game too. And then wondering, did they even watch my, you know, tape? Did they not? Did I look terrible on camera? Oh, but I'm better in the room. Like, there's all of these worries too. But I think the more you can get out of the way and just simply put your best foot forward, prepare what you know, if it's a new piece, prepare what you want to bring to the piece. And if it's an existing piece, do every bit of research you possibly can to be able to, sadly, replicate, you know, as much, because it's now like, you know, a packaged product.
So franchise.
It is the franchise. It's the, you know, if it's now set as a Big Mac, you got to do the Big Mac. You can't add beetroot. Like, you know, well, you could add a bit of flair.
Well, that's a very Australian hamburger, the beetroot.
It is the beetroot. Exactly. So, look, if you want to bring flair to your auditions, just add a bit of beetroot. That's my advice. Thank you. That's my my hook line.
The performer's life, sadly, is often about a lot of rejection.
It is.
What's your advice on handling that rejection, you know?
Gosh, it's such a good question. Because here in Australia, in some ways you can prepare a little better for it, because say if your bag is musical theatre and you may have in Australia 1 to 4 auditions a year, and those 1 to 4 auditions are months apart, you can almost prepare yourself for that audition, and then when you don't get it, you know, have a cry, bash a wall, scream and say how terrible people are, whatever, and then move on. And you go, by the time the next audition comes along, you just go, I'd love to do that. Like, it's gone, you know. But say in America, I mean, there's been times I've had like 5 auditions a day, and you're either trying to do all these self-tapes at home, or you're running from studio to studio, you're trying to look at what material's next, you may or may not have had enough time to learn the material, and you've just got to show up. You just got to go, I'm here now, show up. And then if you don't book it, you just got to move on. It's part of it. It is a really interesting balancing act, because you do have to be like in, boots and all. You have to convince your brain that this is it, you're gonna book it, you're gonna do, and then on the like click of a fingers, blink of an eye, you have to go, oh no, who cares? It's the human brain, it can't function that quickly. Like, the neuroplasticity within the amygdala of the human brain cannot process what is fact and what is fiction, what is truth, what is false. It just can't. It just doesn't know. So in some ways you have that, like, as the upper hand. You just go, I can just trick the brain into thinking whatever. But it is sitting in those moments where you just go, God, I messed up again. Or if you do a perfect audition and it doesn't pan out, like when you start second guessing. But just enjoy the process.
And it's a natural reaction to have a grieving process after a loss.
Yeah.
Whether you lose your mobile phone or whether it's a pet or whether it's a parent. It's how you deal with that grieving process and how long you feel you need to live within it.
Yeah.
So losing a role, you know, could be a month, or it could be, you know, half a day.
Well, and I remember...
If it's sensible, it's half a day.
It's half a day, exactly. Yeah. But I remember, and I'm not sure if you remember this with Lion King, but that audition process went on for, I think, 18 months.
Yes, yes.
And I think the people who were called in the most were called in 13 times. So there were people who were doing the same, and I would get panic calls just going, I'm being called in again, what have I done wrong? I've done something wrong, what have I done wrong? It's like, no. Don't change anything. They just want to remind themselves of you. They want to see you again doing exactly what you've done, and just do that. Everything is going to be on point. But it's just that they're casting like in Europe, they're casting in New York, they're casting the American tour, they're casting everywhere, and they've got all these people in their heads. They're trying to do this jigsaw puzzle. They just need to know that you're who they thought you were. Do exactly what you did again, and everything's going to be golden. No, but there must be something. It's the 13th time I've had to audition with the same material. It must be. And the level, the way that, you know, again, it's the amygdala in the brain, the fight or flight or freeze mechanism, whereby this experience is either like, hi, we'd love you to come into the room and audition. It's either like, no, I don't want to, or freeze, like, oh God. Or, you know, it's, or you just go, there's no need to trigger this, like this response. It's just welcome to the room, do the material, thanks very much. It's business. And I think it's one thing that the Americans do very well. In Australia, it's still very much show business, whereas I think in America there's much more business show. So this is a business. You have every right to prepare this material, ask for an audition, ask what time, change the time if needs be, rock up, do your business off show, and go, thank you, that's what I'm doing, and walk out of the room with your head held high. Whereas here it's like, oh, isn't it exciting? Oh, my God. Which is beautiful. I love that.
Yeah.
But the notion of business of show, this is a legitimate business. You have a legitimate right to be a dancer, a singer, an actor, a triple threat performer, whatever you are in your creative bent. You have every right to walk into that room, present yourself as a business entity, and say, I'm worth money to you. Pick me because I'm worth money to you. I will show up. I'm professional. And here it's like, piss off. Who are you? Like, you know, you wouldn't behave like that.
That's a great observation, you Kate. Yeah, yeah.
You just, well, you know, and here in Australia, it's like there's such a beautiful energy and a camaraderie.
Well, it's a small industry, really, isn't it?
Yes.
Really? Everyone knows everyone.
Yeah. You know, and in the US, there's so much more competition. There's so much more focus on being the best. Whereas here you can be the best, but you know, you wouldn't walk around singing, you know, you just go, oh,
that's
right.
Right. You'd be shot down
down in flames, yeah, you know. Yeah, you wouldn't go, yeah, I can sing a top E flat. Yeah. You go, piss off, who are you? And you, whereas in America, they're like, yeah, I have the best belted E flat in America. And you go, oh, actually you do. You know, so the awareness of skill set and what they're best at, what they're working on, their ability to praise someone who's doing incredible work. It's a really fascinating difference. And I think both are equally valid.
Mm.
And the perfect blend is the mix of the two.
Mm.
Yeah.
So let's go right back. And when did it all begin for little Kay? When were you bitten by the bug?
Here we are. Cast your mind back.
Betty Davis.
Look, I don't come from a performing family at all. My mum's a nurse, my dad's a teacher, my brother's a homicide detective. I wanted to be a hairdresser. That was my dream job. I had terrible eczema, so I couldn't work with the products. And the dermatologist when I was 9 was like, well, you can't be a hairdresser, pick something else. And I was like, what? What do you mean? Like, my life ended at 9. And so it was around that time that my dad came home and said, we're going to go and see a show. And my brother and I were like, it's a show? You didn't know. So my dad had tickets to Annie. Off we went to see Annie. My brother thought it was the worst thing he'd ever experienced in his life. And I was like, clearly, that's what you do. You just go and be Annie.
Yeah.
I didn't really know what it was to be a performer or, you know, what theatre really was.
Was this an original production with Hayes Gordon and Jill Perryman?
Yes.
Nancy Hayes,
yep.
Kevin Johnson.
Yep, and my friend. And then during Superstar, I worked with Gabi Schoeneg, who, you know, the brilliant Gabrielle Schoeneg, who was in every single thing, but she was the Annie that I saw.
Yeah.
And I remember working with her and going, I'm going to talk to you because you're Gabi Schoeneg, you're Annie. And so, yeah, and I was just like, oh, yeah, clearly I'll just do that. Yeah, yeah. And then I heard that there was auditions for Sound of Music, and I didn't audition for Sound of Music, but Todd Goddard, who's a friend, was in that. Rowena Dempsey was in that. There's a whole bunch of gorgeous people in Sound of Music. And I remember, you know, only, what, 10 years ago, meeting Rowena and Todd and just going, oh, my God, you're in Sound of Music. You're like those famous people. They're like, what are you talking about? But I remember hearing on the radio about the auditions.
Formative years and formative experiences, which yeah, stayed with your lifetime.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. And to see those beautiful people up there being just tremendous. And I remember hearing on the radio about the auditions, and lots of children have rocked up to the Sound of Music auditions. And some child had been interviewed, and she'd worn a cape to the audition, and I remember thinking, how am I ever going to do this? I don't have a cape. How am I going to audition for shows without a cape? I need a cape. And I remember thinking, I'd learned a song on you're probably too young for Sing Sing Together, Merrily Merrily Sing, when they would have the tannoys in the school classrooms.
You're gorgeous. How old do you think I am? No, I absolutely do. The ABC Sing Book.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
Sing a song. Sing. Little boxes on the hills. All sorts of
inchworm,
songs.
Inchworm. Yeah.
So, never roller skate in a buffalo herd.
That's the one. Well, I was planning to sing Donna, 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 Donna. On a wagon bound for market, here's a calf with a mournful eye. And I remember planning that I was going to like wipe my face because it was a very, very sad song. So, but I never got to audition for The Sound of Music. So life went on. I started doing amateur musicals with...
great way to start.
Fantastic. And I mean, I assume they're still going now. Mm. I was at like McKellar Musical Society, a society which no longer exists, Willoughby, and then there was also The Theatre Company out at Ryde.
Did you ever get to do Annie?
I never did. No.
Still time. There's a Hannigan in you somewhere.
I know. That'd be a fun role. I think last time I auditioned, it was for Lily. So we'll see. We'll put that. We'll touch wood that still happens, because I'd love to play Hannigan. That'd be fun.
Unless you want to shave your head.
Oh, well, listen, these days, you never know. You never know. I played a man on Broadway, so,
we'll
maybe
talk about that.
We will. Yeah. Then just kept doing amateur musicals. I then, you know, I met people like Michelle Guthrie, people who Gregory Urizich, Simone Young, Michael Turkish, John Milson was a director at McKellar, and I'm just like, so all these people who had sort of done it all, but still involve themselves in community development, which is really cool.
So yeah. Was Mills your connection with WAPA? Is that how you found out about WAPA?
No, I found out about WAPA because I was doing a theatre and education play. Was the first thing I booked, a theatre and education play, a couple of commercials, and then my first big show that I booked was Rasputin, and I booked
John English,
yeah. And I wasn't Equity at the time, and they advertised for an open call of performers to audition for Rasputin. I auditioned for Rasputin, I booked it, and I called the union and said, hi, I called and said, you know, and I was told if I had a contract I could join. And then Equity said, oh, no, this is a mistake, and they pulled my contract. So, yeah, I couldn't do it. They said, no, Equity members need to be hired before you get a shot. And I was like, oh. So I was devastated at age 17. And then I booked The Importance of Being Earnest. So I went on tour with that for a year. And it was through the theatre and education play, Marriott Rubbs Donnelly played my mother. And she had said, you know, there's this new school open in Perth. So, you know, when you get to Perth with, you know, this show that you're about to do, go make an appointment to go and see John Milson. I was like, John Milson? I had never worked with John Milson, but he, you know, he was with this, you know, theatre company. She said, make an appointment, go and see him, go and check out the campus. I think it could be a good match. So that was that. That was the match for that. So, yeah, when we got to Perth with beautiful Harley Medcalf, who's the producer of Burn the Floor, he set us all up in Subiaco and made an appointment to go and see Milson and auditioned at the end of the year and got in.
You must have been there in the very sort of first 5 years of the course.
It was. So I started in 1990, you know, yeah. So I think Dobbo had been there prior, and
Lara Marquet and Lisa McKeon.
Yeah, yep, they were still
Tim Lawson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Marty Cruz, Jenny Campbell Coles, Charmaine Clements. They were in third year when I was in first year. So yeah.
Wow.
So that was the connection to that.
And it's great, isn't it, that I was there in 96. I graduated, so I started in 94.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So not long after you.
Yeah.
But it's wonderful to sort of continually meet brothers and sisters who have studied at the place and graduated after us.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, 100%.
And a great team training us too, with Milson and Dennis Follington and Derek Bond.
Yeah, and certainly that it was... You know, I think you're right, that thing of when you're a part of something and you see it just keep morphing and shifting, and yet you're all part of the same alumni, you're part of the same cloth, and you're always there to support each other and have great memories and great laughs and stuff. And, you know, I guess once I graduated, no agents wanted me. I was a massive loser. It took me ages to get an agent.
Why? Because you were so unique, do you think? Or they had, you know, five Kate Tuckerman types?
I don't know. Yeah. I just assumed at the time I was just a massive loser.
Right.
So I just don't know.
And so the psychological game begins.
It begins. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And somehow you get into your head and you just go, I must be a massive loser. And it was Penny Williams ended up taking me on, you know, the old battle axe
Penny Williams.
Penny,
yeah.
You know, which, I mean, now I don't even think you'd be able to agent in the way that Penny agented, you know.
Or teach in the way Mills taught.
I would 100%.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think there'd be tribunals. Absolutely. But it is interesting how you navigate through that world, and I think there's always going to be highs and lows, as you know, in a career in the arts, and to be able to support each other with, you know, with the lows, and to be able to cheer each other on during the highs, I think is really important. And I finally booked Penny. I finally started booking all the shows. Olympics came along, so I worked on the Olympics and went and studied directing, and then everything just went madness.
What was the first gig you scored? Because
Buddy Holly. Yeah, yeah.
Great.
Yeah, so after I graduated, I almost booked Return to the Forbidden Planet. It was between me and Tony Pearin. And Jacobson's called me and said, we just want to call you because we thought your audition was so fantastic, but you got to understand we're going to go with Tony Pearin. And, you know,
how nice to get that call.
It was so lovely. And that was also the conduit to them saying, look, in any way we can help you, you know. And I said, well, actually, I'm trying to get an agent. And they were the ones who connected me with Penny to set up a meeting.
Great.
So, you know, there was all these little things. And it's funny, yeah, because these little hurdles or these roadblocks or these things that just seem like devastating somehow open a door to something else, and actually you find yourself where you're meant to be. So, you know, I don't know.
You've been on the barricades.
I've been on the barricades.
You've been on a Greek island.
I have.
You've had maracas in your hands.
I have.
You've been a rocket.
I have been a rocket.
Les Mis' Boy from Oz, Dusty,
yeah.
Mamma Mia. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Chalking up quite a resume in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah, I was really lucky. Really lucky, you know. And, you know, I've been to Jerusalem. I've been with Jesus. You know,
Hosanna Hazanna,
indeed, yeah.
Now, people are thinking, what are they talking about? But the music theatre aficionados
will know.
Identify
I
our
know.
Illusions, Kate.
I know, and if they don't know, they should start buying CDs and records.
Exactly. So the move to New York, what brought that about? You're obviously experiencing success in Australia. You just wanted to...
I think it had always been the dream. Like, so say,
take a bite of the Big Apple.
Yeah, McKellar Theatre Company. So my first amateur musical was Oliver. And I was so bad. Like, I was talking to some friends yesterday from McKellar. And I was sort of like a potato up the back, sort of going, what am I doing here? Like, what? Why? Why am I doing this? And my one solo line in Oliver was, who will buy her sweet red roses? Like, so terrified, so bad. And for some reason, I went back to do Pippin as my second show, and I thought, well, you better do something good, because you're terrible. Like, and if you're going to keep showing up, you can't annoy everybody in this amateur theatre company by being so bad and being this potato up the back. And so, yeah, I pulled out a few swift dance moves and gymnastics moves, and, you know, everyone went, oh, you're not a potato. And I was like, whew, thanks. But the man that was involved with McKellar and directed and choreographed Pippin was a hoofer from Broadway, and his name was Robert Wells. And Robert Wells always spoke about the Big Apple and the Broadway. I didn't even know what he was talking about, but I was just like, I was like 13. I'm just like going, yeah, I'm going to do that. Yeah. So I'm going to go to Broadway. So I guess that seed was planted when I was 13. And in some ways, I guess the psychology was that I was so bad and such a potato, and this man planted this seed about, you know, Broadway is the goal. And so Broadway became the goal, you know, and it didn't even compute at that time that you needed a visa to go there. Yeah. Like, that didn't compute. So yeah, just gradually.
And of course, the Yanks invented the musical theatre form, so... You know, you want to go and conquer it in its homeland.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, when we see the British musicals, it's come from, you know, a foundation in musical. And when you see the American, the real Broadway musicals, it's all that foundation in vaudeville. And then, you know, the development of that art form to, you know, the nth degree. And when you see the best of the best Broadway musicals, it's just like, my God, the Broadway dancers, there's nothing like them. Like,
I agree. Unbelievable. I agree. So how do you get a visa or a green card?
So, yeah, it was a really interesting turn of events, as often happens in my life. I had been in Africa designing films. I had come back to Australia to do the Adelaide Cabaret Festivals. I'd gone back had gone up to Macau to do some corporates, and then over to Nairobi again to do some films. Then I went over to New York just to sort of catch up with some people. And while I was there, I got a call from Ross Mollison because he had Spiegelman in New York, and Paul Capsis needed to miss a show. And he needed to miss more than one. And Meow Meow was able to fill in for 10 of the 11 shows. And there was one show that he needed somebody for. And so I got this call and said, look, I need one. Can you just dive into Spiegelman for one night? And I was like, yeah, no worries. So I did Spiegelman for one night. Then the following year, he offered me Spiegelman Miami and New York again. So for that... For that type of contract, it's called a P1 visa, which is basically a producer-specific visa. That producer will hire you, they will bring you to the country, you can work for that producer and that producer only. So when I was wrapping up that contract, I was like, oh, I wonder if I can extend it. So I went and saw the immigration lawyer that, you know, Caroline and Josh Horner had used. So, and he was like, well, okay, you could get an
is this
old,
George?
Yeah, beautiful George Axt. Yeah, yeah, who's no longer with us. Yeah. And he was like, oh, you know, I think we could get you an O1, but I think that, you know, you got a good case for a green card. Anyway, you get you a green card. And I was like... And I don't know, I went into some form of trance, I handed over $3,000 and walked out of the building and sort of went, I guess I just applied for a green card, I don't know. So, yeah, I went back to Kenya. It took a year for that visa to come through, and it's quite an extensive process. And, yeah, it was on my birthday. I was working on the... coast of north of Mombasa in Kenya, and I got a call from George, and he was like, well, happy birthday, Barack Obama's just given you a visa. And I was like, oh my God. So then, you know, you get the visa, and then it takes another 6 months for that to come through. So then I had to pick it up in Sydney. I had to go and, like, you know, do my stamping and everything at the Sydney office, and then was able to move to America. And I don't know, it just seems so unbelievable, like, you know, that this thing that's an impossible dream, you know, you've just basically got the golden ticket in your hand to try and step towards that dream. And yeah, so I got there and I was like sort of like a kitten in a new home. You know, you walk around an apartment just going, what am I doing here? Like, what an idiot. And then I started, you know, in New York they have these things called I mean, people will cynically call them pay to play, which is you can pay to do a class with the casting directors. And I can see the cynical side of it, but also for someone like me who didn't really know anybody, I was like, $100 to meet a bunch of casting directors, I'm in. So from that, I met the casting directors of from Tyra Rubin's office, who cast like Les Mis and Phantom and all those things,
yeah.
Almost everything, and the most wonderful, wonderful, lovely people. And yeah, 7 weeks, I went to an Equity Chorus call for Mamma Mia, and a week later, I was offered the contract to play Donna Sheridan on the Broadway national tour of Mamma Mia. So that was my first job in America.
Before we get to Broadway and the dream,
yeah.
Africa. You just and then I was in Nairobi, and then I was on the Mombasa coast. What were you doing in Africa? How?
Well, I'm glad you asked.
And I also understand that you speak Swahili.
Ndio, mimi ninajaribu kuongea Kiswahili, lakini mimi sijui kile kitu kwa sababu mimi wazi mapumbafu. So, yes,
very
I speak a little Swahili. Yeah, it's a bit rusty now. But no, I had this offer to a girl I had directed at ATYP, was script supervisor on a television series in Nairobi, and she said, you need to come and do this, you're going to be the art director. And I was like, no, I'm not. I've never art directed a television series before. She was like, no, you'll be great. You understand performance, you understand directing, you understand design, you just have to put all of those together on a TV set. And I'm like, no. And she said, yeah, message me tomorrow. Tell me your answer tomorrow. And I thought about it overnight, and I was like, why not? So
say
she
say yes to everything.
Say
yeah.
yes. And yeah. So I went, I art directed the television series Makitano Junction for 2 seasons, and that series is edutainment. So every episode has to have an element of educational content. And so I did that. Then I was invited to go back and design From a Whisper, which is a feature film, for which I was nominated for an African Academy Award for production design. So I have that. And then, yeah, I just kept going back and designing either television series, documentaries, docudramas, edutainment, educational stuff, television series, feature films, you know, Raw Television, National Geographic, Discovery Channel, independent stuff, big commercials like the Nike campaign for Alejandro, what's his name, that Oscar-winning director guy, Alejandro Iñárritu González, and Shivo filmed it, and like just the most incredible people. And so I was there on and off for 6 years.
Wow. Well, there you go. That's a fabulous chapter for your book.
Like,
your
yeah.
Life. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Yeah. So playing Donna Sheridan in Mamma Mia, doing the national tour. Regional theatre, is that essential to get a few credits before you'll be taken as a possible performer on Broadway? Did you feel that you needed to do that, or this was the jobs that were offered?
So I think it's many fingers and many pies in terms of avenues to get to Broadway. I think that's changing now with so much focus now, thank God, on diversity and inclusivity. I think there are a lot of people going straight to Broadway because the shows are requiring different looks and different types of talent. So if we go back 10 years when I did Mamma Mia, I hadn't done any regional stuff. And then even with the regional stuff, there are the big out-of-town tryout houses like La Jolla, like The Globe, and then there are the smaller, you know, more community-based regional places, which are just small, sweet summer stock houses, and then they close up during the rest of the year. So I think it it does depend on, you know, how you get. But then, so the other thing with that too is union membership, that a lot of those smaller houses, if people are not a union member and you need to be a member of American Equity to be on Broadway, then a lot of people will try and build up their weeks in those smaller regional houses, and there'll be designated houses across the country that, you know, will say, oh yeah, 4 weeks here, you know, that will contribute to your equity weeks to get your equity card. So, and then the bigger houses like La Jolla is where they will take the Come From Aways, the Donna Summer musicals, the musicals that are gonna, you know, be tested to go, you know, onto Broadway for the next season. So it's slightly different. And my trajectory was a little unusual, you know. I mean, to book from an ECC, an Equity Chorus Call, is pretty much unheard of. But I don't know. I just moved there. They needed someone to play Donna. They reference checked me. They Equity demanded to see my green card to make sure I was able to work. It was really fascinating. They called Andrew Lipper to make sure that I wasn't, you know, that I could do the job. They'd called a couple of contacts at Disney. They called Maltby and Shire. So to, yeah, basically reference check and say, how was your experience working with Kay? Was she okay? Should we hire her? And they were like, yeah, hire her. And so it was a slightly different, strange kind of thing. And yeah, I remember when it was all happening, I called my friend Christy Ann Knoll, and I was like, what is this? What does this mean? And she just started laughing. She said, you're going to book a national tour, Broadway national tour. And I was like, what? No. So, and yeah, sure enough, yeah, the next day they said, they want to offer you the job of Donna Sheridan on the Broadway national tour. Mm. So
great show to be part of, yeah.
Great show to be part of. And, you know, to have it as an entry into the American market was, you know, a really lovely experience. There's such a beautiful, supportive, creative team. You know, you get opening night messages from Benny and Bjorn and Judy Kramer, and just, you know, you could be in, you know, some smaller town like Schenectady or something, or Saginaw, Michigan, and you'll get, you know, an opening night message from Benny and Bjorn, and you just go, like, just lovely, lovely people, generous, kind, funny, like the most perfect balance of professionalism and skill and humor and humility and empathy. Just fantastic people. So yeah,
Pete Bellotte.
Mm-hmm.
Who was Pete Bellotte? So Pete in Bellotte, relation to Donna Summer.
Yeah, so Pete Bellotte and Giorgio Moroder. So
I've heard of him.
So Pete Bellotte is the unknown Giorgio Moroder. So the big team, music producing team of that era, were Giorgio and Pete. And they were
the disco era.
Yeah, experimenting with, you know, the Korg sounds and, you know, figuring out looping. And they started that. And they'd heard of Donna in Germany. And they were like, well, you know, maybe, because Donna was doing Hair in Germany, and they were like, well, you know, after you finish rehearsals or something, come over and, you know, we can play with some ideas. And that's where they finally found that doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot. And they're like, what do you think of this? And they're like, oh. And then she started riffing on that. And it, this whole thing built. And then, of course, that track, I think the original track is like 16 minutes or something.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they were like, well, here's the, they sent that track to America. And, you know, it's like, Giorgio and Pete, here's the track. And, of course, all the record producers were just going, you cannot release on the radio a 16-minute track. No one will listen to it. And they were like, well, we just think it's going to work. Like, we're not going to cut it down. Like, tank it if you want.
Yeah.
And it was released, and it just went, people went nuts.
DJs would love it. They'd just go outside and have three smokes.
Exactly. So that's Pete Bellotte.
So what was the conceit of the you know, this jukebox musical about Donna Summer? Was it an all-female cast that you're playing a fella?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And I think the creative teams, you know, because it's the Jersey Boys creative team, and they had, over the years of auditioning people, just gone, you know, my God, there's all these great men that we've got roles for. There's all these great women that we've got a few roles for. Like, how can we build a show around, you know, women and you know, hiring as many women as we can. And so, you know, Jersey Boys was still running. They had Donna Summer in development. They also had Ain't Too Proud in development. And so, yeah, I remember getting the audition brief, and it was, my original audition was for Giorgio Moroder, and I remember going, oh my god, this sounds unreal, like, oh, Donna Summer, love Donna Summer, this is great, please prepare Giorgio Moroder. And I'm like, I called my agent, I was like, I'd love to, this sounds great, but I just want to check, because it's for the role of Giorgio. And they were like, yep, they're cross-casting everything. It's a whole entire female cast. So, yeah, there was four men. There was the pastor, her father, and her manager, and an assistant. So they were the four men.
Well, yeah. That's the beautiful thing about theatre, isn't it? If you set up the playing rules for the show with the audience from the start, we suspend our disbelief, don't we?
And exactly, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it's like that, you know, I think anything in terms of storytelling, you're 100% right. If you set the premise, it's like if a little kid comes out and says, okay, we're in a spaceship, you go, all right, we are. Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, the best shows do that, when you just go, okay, it's a whole ensemble of women, we're going to be doing everything, you got it, cool, let's go on. You know, it's a curious instinct of the dog does it too. You know, they're just like, I'm the neighbor, Mrs. Shearer, you know, and I'm playing an ATM now. You know, Matthew Shepard, the Laramie Project, do it too.
Yeah.
I'm the woman who lives down the road. It's like, okay, yes, you are.
We know now, we'll go with that.
We know, yeah.
So was it called Donna Summer? Just Summer,
the Donna Summer musical.
Was that sadly a casualty of the pandemic?
No, we finished just before the pandemic. So it was interesting. I wrapped up Summer at the very beginning of 2019. 2019, I was working on a whole bunch of film stuff, and then at the beginning of 2020, I just shot a feature film, and we were about to do pickups when they went, March 2020, no pickups happening, we're not going to be doing any of that. So no, it wasn't. But I remember I was at the theatre with Andrew Lippar. We went to see Tina at the L'Enfantine, where Donna Summer, when we wrapped Tina the musical, went into the L'Enfantine. And we'd had dinner beforehand, and we were like, what do you think of this pandemic thing? And I was just like, I'm telling you, within days, everything is going to be shut. It's about to go down. And they're like, really? You think it's that bad? And I'm like, yep, that's my bet. That is my bet. Sure enough. So we saw the show on the Tuesday, the 9th of March, and Broadway was shut on the 12th. The 11th and the 12th.
What was your New York experience like during those 2 years of the pandemic?
Oh!
How did you amuse yourself? What, were you fearful?
Yes. And I think the introverts did better. So as an introvert, I was like, stay at home. This sounds great. It sounds great. How long? 2 weeks? 6 months? It's great. You know, it was coming out of the pandemic when you had to reassimilate into society again that I was like, oh my God, I don't know how to do this. But yeah, it was scary because everything was shut down. We were told to stay inside. We would hang out our windows at 7 p.m. every day, like banging pots and pans for the first responders. I mean, 3 people in my co-op died during the pandemic. 1,500 people a day were dying. I have friends.
Well, they were setting up morgues in Central Park.
They had the triage tent in Central Park. They had all the freezer trucks outside the hospitals. They were digging trenches, you know, on the islands to just sort of put, you know, bodies. They had the naval ship came up and parked at the pier at 44th Street. The Javits Center, which is like the big convention center down in Darling Harbour, that was converted by the military into a military hospital. It was like crazy. And I remember the first time I ever went out, I went down Midtown, and it was 1:50 p.m. on a Saturday. Not a soul in Times Square. All the theaters were boarded up with plywood. There was like two sad people in Times Square going, pamphlet, or I'm doing a dance. It's like, I don't know who you're dancing for because there's no one here. This is a zombie apocalypse. Like, yeah, it was very, very strange.
The suit people weren't even there.
The suit people were. The mind Grover you, they could have been fine because they had a mask on. But yeah, it was really strange because nobody knew what it was. And the high density of Manhattan really felt it. And I remember, you know, we'd be messaging with people in Australia and they're like, but there's no cases in Australia. Or Melbourne's been shut down, but, you know, like New York, it was like, this and you were stuck in it. Yeah, it was bad.
Are you still working on Take Your Seats, the documentary?
Yeah, so I've got Take Your Seats. So that's got to be, now that everything's open again, we've got to do follow-up interviews for that. And it's a really interesting piece because, I mean, talking to those performers and talking to Tony Magna, who was in the room when they knew the announcement was coming from Cuomo as to what was going to happen with the theatres, and they were at the Broadway League, and they were like literally there just going, okay. And then it was announced all Broadway theatres, at 3 p.m. it was announced that all Broadway theatres would shut at 5. So they all just split. They all ran from the drama league to their respective Broadway theatres. Started printing out all the notes. Started calling all the cast members. You know, people were on the bus or the train coming into Manhattan when they were getting messages going, no, and they're just going, okay, turn around. I guess just people not knowing. People going to physiotherapy appointments and just going, I guess I'll keep going and having physio and getting there, and everybody just being there, just going, well, I don't know. But the saddest thing, I was having coffee with a friend on 47th Street. I finished coffee with her and I walked up because I had physiotherapy that day too. And it was the opening night of Six that day. And I saw the stage door of Six was open with the stage door guy talking to the florist guy who had all the bouquets of flowers for all the cast for their opening night bouquets from the producers. And the two of them just going, I don't know. Done, you know, and it was just the strangest, most surreal thing to see these two people like just going, we don't know what to do. There's no opening night, and thanks for the flowers, but I don't know, take them back. I don't know.
Well, preparing this documentary, you must have unearthed lots of fascinating stories like that.
Yeah, yeah. And people too, like there was a couple of graduates that I spoke to, and they were like, we just graduated. We don't know now. Like, we're at peak fitness now. Like, and that sounds crazy, like at 23 to just say, maybe this is it. Maybe I'll never book a job. Maybe I'll never have another audition, get a call back. Maybe I'll never work on Broadway, book a TV series. Maybe all this hard work to get to this peak elite fitness level. We don't know how long we don't know. I don't know what my fitness level will be like in 2 years, like I don't know.
And so many people leaving the industry too.
Well, that's the other side, is other people had babies, people left the city, people just went, I'm good, I'm out, you know, I've had my time, I'm good, I won't do it anymore.
And businesses, you know, I was reading a story about the costume manufacturer, mm-hmm. who looked like going bust, and if they did, there would be no one left one less house left to make the costume.
Yeah, like all the wig makers or the... Like, there's such specialty bespoke industries in Manhattan that they've got, like, floors of buildings that build all the costumes, that build all the wigs, that build all the shoes. Like what else can I do? Like, I don't know. And yet it was all put on pause for, like, 2 years. I mean, it's coming back now, but, you know, it's a really odd thing. And even the stage managers we were talking to, they were just like, well, we got the call, we had to go into the theatre, and one of the they told people that to take everything for 2 weeks, you know, that was the time frame at that minute, 2 weeks. So, you know, maybe don't leave sandwiches in the dressing room, take all that. But people, you know, then had to go back later to just go, well, my makeup's still there, or, you know, I've got shoes there or training equipment there. So they're allowed back in. But they're talking about, one was leaving the ghost light on the stage and just leaving the space. But the other big thing was, because the theatres are so old and the piping systems are so old in New York, there's all the water, they had to keep working out how they were going to keep filtering water through the pipes and not let it go stagnant while no water was going through the pipes for those 2 weeks, 6 months, years. Because otherwise the theatres all would have had to be pulled down, or every single pipe in every single theatre would have had to be redone because it just poisonous...
Well, I heard stories of locally, you know, cinemas who were dark for long periods of time began to be infested with mice and rats who came out to sort of look for popcorn pieces and all that sort of thing, because, you know, there was no movement in that space for a long time. So
100%.
They had to repair seats and chairs. And,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, the rats in New York are the size of this table, so they were just like, this is ours now. Like, they were just going to eat whoever entered the building. But yeah, interesting things you don't even think about, because you just go, oh gosh, now that we're not using the taps and the air conditioning systems, that creates a whole other ball game. And then when we reopen again and we've got people with masks and, you know, trying to prevent people from getting COVID, like, we're going to blast these old air conditioning systems and kill everybody with, I don't know, some sort of botulism or something, I don't know.
Well, I look forward to seeing your doco, Take Your Seats.
Take Your Seats, yeah.
Well, Kate Tuckerman, you'll be delighted that I've awarded you full marks for your specialist subject, Kate Tuckerman.
I was worried. I was like, what if I get things wrong?
No, I think you've done really, really well. And how fortuitous to run into you at the Sydney Theatre Awards and say, hey, let's have a chat.
I know. I was like, oh, I feel like I've won a gold star. It's such a lovely, lovely invitation, a lovely honour. Oh, so,
you know,
thank
part
you
of
so
the
much.
Stage as alumni.
Like, oh.
There you go.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your stay and travel back safely to NYC.
We'll go to Singapore first to direct the Addams Family and then back to NYC.
Is that at LaSalle or something?
Is.
It is fantastic.
Yeah. So I'll be out there for 2 months with the students up there, and talking about the pandemic, it's their first time. They've been able to do small presentations and stuff, but this is third years will be their big performance as musical theatre graduates, because everything's been shut down because of the pandemic.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you're no doubt aware that, you know, our dear friend Dennis Follington from WAPA set up the course.
I am. I'm very, very, very aware. Yeah. And I'd been up there working on some stuff just after Dennis had finished and Tony McGill had taken over. And I've been up there since when Tony McGill was running it to direct Once on This Island and another big like cabaret show. And then this time I'll go back again to do the Addams Family. Yeah.
Well, good luck.
Thanks.
Thanks, Kay.
Ah!
Kay is a constant source of inspiration and a vibrant example of not letting grass grow under one's feet. Great to see you, Kay, and let's hope it's not so long between drinks next time. Stage's next featured guest is Angela Ayres, known for a string of musical triumphs such as A Chorus Line, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, Guys and Dolls, Jerry's Girls, and Menopause the Musical, as well as extensive singing credits on stage and television throughout Australia and New Zealand. She's recently turned her hand to writing and has just launched her first children's book titled Two Little Kiwi Birds. We discuss this new direction along with revisiting her sojourns in musical theatre across several decades. Thanks for joining us in this episode. You can check out all of the episodes featured in the podcast thus far by visiting our website, www.stagespodcast.com.au. I'm Peter Ayres. Keep well, keep warm, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.